Hi, this is Bob Wells here, and welcome to Undercurrent Stories. This is the show where we hear about people's interests and uncover some fascinating stories at the same time. I hope you enjoy today's show. Hello and welcome to Undercurrent Stories. In today's show, I'm delighted to be joined by Jeff Holt, MBE. On the 5th of September 1984, 18-year-old Jeff Holt dived into an idyllic tropical sea and his life changed forever. A broken neck cut short a promising career as a yachtsman and left him paralysed, with his horizons reduced to an uncertain future in a wheelchair. On the 5th of September 2007, after a journey of 109 days and 1,445 miles, Jeff crossed the finish line in the Solent and reached the summit of his personal Everest, the first quadriplegic yachtsman to sail single-handedly around Great Britain. Since then, Jeff has gone on to receive numerous awards, completed a sail across the Atlantic and formed Wet Wheels, which we'll talk about later, an organisation that takes disabled people to sea. Hello and welcome to the show, Jeff.
Hello, and thank you for having me. That was quite an introduction.
Well, I mean, there was a lot more I could have said, Jeff, but, I'm sure we'll get to that later. It's great to have you on. I will just mention to listeners, we have a mutual friend, Tim Clare, who sort of put us in touch with each other and lent me your fantastic book, Walking on Water, which came out, I believe, in 2008.
It did, yes, 2008. That's a long time ago now. It seems like yesterday.
Yeah, it's an amazing story. And I was actually going to form the basis of the interview sort of on that, but obviously 15 years has passed since then. And so there's a lot more to talk about. Tim lent me the book, great book, and I can thoroughly recommend it.
Well, it's interesting that the Tim connection, because Tim, as we're going to get to, you know, shortly, you know, we met 38 years ago now in a hospital ward, and we've remained great friends ever since. But that we've both been on our journey, so it's lovely to connect to you through Tim.
Yeah, well, it's great. I mean, we actually play online chess with each other. And I think I've been playing with him for about 2.5 years and I've never beaten him, but I drew with him the other day.
I know he liked his chess.
He certainly does. And he's got very good. Anyway, just before we talk about all your sort of exploits and achievements, how did you get into sailing as a young boy, Jeff?
So I kind of fell into it because my stepdad at the time had a yacht, had a sailboat. And when my mum went through the divorce and married my stepdad when I was about six, something, quite young, we moved from Portsmouth to the new marital home, which was in somewhere called Lower Swanwick. And it's right near the top of the Hamble River down in Hampshire. And it's fairly idyllic. It was a sort of Victorian cottage, not far, you know, opposite a boatyard, where the boat was moored, and having a boat, and my stepfather being a sailor himself, we would go away at weekends and enjoying the holidays. And at the time, when you're young, actually, that it was a bit of an inconvenience. I'd rather stay at home with my friends. We're going sailing again, and I guess without realizing it, over the years, I was picking up skills. I was learning to navigate, learning to sail. It became second nature to me, and I would often, take the helm and plan routes, our journeys. And so that it was just part of my life. It was just growing up. I was on the river and was sailing most weekends and holidays. So that's how it started.
And you've never really looked back in terms of the sailing, have you?
Well, the thing is, when when I got to 16, I was very lucky. I went to a fairly nice school in Southampton. But at 16, my friends were going on to college, and I was not academic. I could not see myself going and doing another 2 years at college. Yeah. And about that time, one of the big boats next to us were called Morag Moor, which was a big aluminium ketch owned by Baco, the British aluminium foil company. Was off to the Med for 6 months, and they offered me this job as a 16-year-old to live aboard, £13 a week, and we were going to go and do some chartering for their corporate guests in the Med. So at 16, I jumped on Morag Moor. We sailed down to the Med, me and the skipper Brian, and I did my apprenticeship, you'd say, in the yachting world with Brian. And I learned so much in those 6 months, not just the sailing. It was about working on a working yacht, you know, a charter yacht, how to deal with guests and things. And I guess that's where it really started. And as you say, I didn't look back after that.
It's been in your genes, so to speak.
Yeah, because that immediately led to, I got back from that 6 months. I'm 16. I get back from 6 months in the Med. All my mates are at college, you know, drinking beer down the pub. And I'd just grown up. I'd grown up so much. And within a week or two, I was offered the job to sail an 80-foot ocean racing yacht across to Antigua. So I did that. And I was still 16 years old.
Yeah.
That was 3,000 miles. The moment I got to Antigua, Christmas 82, there was a letter waiting for me from my mum and dad saying, there's an American who's just bought a really big Bowman 55-foot yacht, which he wants a permanent crew on. Yes. So there was a check in the envelope to fly back Christmas Day, 82. And I jumped on my second yacht and sailed it across the Atlantic. I was still 16 years old.
Wow.
I look back now, my son's now 20, by the way, and I look back when he was 16 thinking, I'd sailed the Atlantic twice and I'd done all these things. But so I was very lucky, and I ended up landing in the Virgin Islands in the Caribbean, and particularly the British Virgin Islands, and an island called Tortola. And it was there that I worked on several yachts and kind of cut my teeth, really, in the corporate charter world in the Virgin Islands.
Yes.
And of course, that was ultimately to be where my life changed forever.
Are you happy to talk about that, Jeff?
Yeah, absolutely. Crikey, I think I've talked enough about it over the years.
Yeah.
It's kind of it is vivid now as it was then. So I in 84, so I'd been out there 2.5 years. I was invited back to work on a beautiful charter yacht. I flew out from the UK on the 4th of September 84. Arrived in Puerto Rico and then flew up island to the Virgin Islands. Went to the lawyer and completed all my work papers. So I'm now technically on the books. I'm going to be a first mate on this beautiful Irwin 65 charter yacht, one of the most beautiful sailing yachts in the Virgin Islands. Completed all my paperwork and had a few hours to spare. So we went to a beach called Cane Garden Bay with a friend of mine. Just sat down, sat on this beautiful palm-lined sandy beach, no one on the beach. Decided to go for a swim, ran down the beach, ran into the water, up to my knees, put my arms above my head, dived forward and hit my head on a sandbar, which was just below the surface, and bang. I mean, it didn't hurt. No. It didn't hurt at all. Looking back, never hurt. But I didn't lose consciousness. I remember holding my breath, just rising and falling, looking at the sand coming up to my nose and then down and then up and then down, and thinking, I can't move. I went to turn, I just couldn't move. I tried to flip left, right. It was just like being stunned. And I started thinking, oh my goodness, if I don't get turned over, I'm going to drown. I'm going to breathe in and drown.
Yeah.
And luckily, a friend of mine who was with me at the time, he rolled me over and said, are you all right? And I couldn't even speak. I think he saw in my eyes there was a problem.
Yeah.
And he pulled me out, and that was it. The 5th of September.
So he saved your life, Jeff.
Oh, 100%.
Yeah.
Yeah, I wouldn't tell him that because he's still my best mate. I don't want him having bragging rights, but
no.
He did absolutely save my life called an ambulance. And then you realize that actually your world's turned upside down in so many ways, and particularly immediate urgent healthcare. Critical healthcare out there just doesn't exist. So I was luckily the US Coast Guard threw me in the back of a Coast Guard helicopter and flew me something like out of Apocalypse Now up the islands at dusk and took me to Puerto Rico. And I spent a month in Puerto Rico whilst they tried to repatriate me. And that itself was a challenge. It took a month to get me back. The company I worked for that I'd signed all the papers said that they refused to acknowledge any liability, so they washed their hands of me. The British government washed their hands of me, particularly Kenneth Clark, and I will never forget, he denied foreign aid to get me flown back. He specifically wrote a letter saying no. So my parents had no money, And were it not for British Caledonian Airways, who are sadly no longer with us,
yeah.
British Caledonian Airways, they do you remember the Daily Express or one of those papers used to do mercy flights?
Yes, where, yes.
You do remember those things occasionally? Help us get someone back.
Yeah, yeah.
And they did a mercy flight shout out. And Caledonian rose to the challenge and gave up 13 seats on a scheduled airliner and flew me back and back to Salisbury Hospital in Salisbury, which is the spinal unit up at Oddstock, just north in the hill outside Salisbury, in October 1984. And it had just been opened by Prince Charles and Lady Diana in July. And I arrived in October, one of the first patients in, and who was in the bed next to me, but our mutual friend, Tim Clare.
Tim, and do you know what? I would have met you, Jeff, and you probably won't remember, and I don't remember. It's a long time ago now. But obviously, I used to go and visit Tim. But what I remember is you had several friends there, and the wicked sense of humour you all had.
Well, funny enough, people ask me, and it's genuinely, I get asked this a lot, how did you come to terms with your disability?
Yeah.
And if I'm brutally honest, and this, I apologies if this sounds sexist or whatever, but four blokes, I was the youngest, Tim was about 20. We were four lads, we couldn't show emotion to each other. So no. If anyone complained of anything, we were merciless in the way we ribbed each other.
Yeah.
And as time went on, it was a coping mechanism. Yeah. It's how we coped. We boxed it up and we didn't show anything. And what I mean about sex is, I'm not sure if that's a blokey thing. Maybe I'm being a bit unfair to say that, but I just felt the way all four of us are still really good friends now. You know, Dizzy, Tim, Dave and myself, 38 years old and still get together for time to time, go to the rugby or something. And that friendship was born from spending 10 months in a four-bedded room with each other. You know, growing up, I was 18, I think the oldest probably was Dave, who was in his early 20s. All of us three of us have broken our necks. Dizzy had broken his back. All of us coming to terms with young men has a changed life for someone with a severe disability. Yeah. And I think that was our coping mechanism. Maybe it's different now. But we were brutal to each other. Yeah, it was dark humour. Yeah. But
no, it was quite obvious that there was a lot of ribbing going on. But you know, for best reasons, really. I mean, I won't spoil some of the content of the book, because obviously some people might want to read this after we've done this interview, and we'll put the links onto it in the show notes. But there's one particular incident where you guys managed to get a bed put into a corridor. Are you happy to share that with the listeners?
Yeah. So you have to remember, we've got a lot of time on our hands. Yeah, once you're up in your wheelchair, you've got a lot of time on your hands. And the way the unit used to run, they had shifts with, we knew who was coming on shift. We knew the nurses and the auxiliaries. Heaven's sake, I married one of them. So we were, you know, we all knew each other really well and we still keep in touch. So we knew the shifts, we knew their patterns, we knew when they had their breaks. And bear in mind, I ought to explain, I'm quadriplegic. So what that means is I'm paralyzed from the chest down. I've got limited arm movement. I'm the same as Tim, by the way. Dave is very similar. So we all broke our necks. So it means that we can't grip anything with our hands. We have no triceps. We can't raise our hands above. Well, I can't raise my arm above my head. And we have no core muscle. So we kind of sat there. You know, if we are in a wheelchair, a non-electric one, we use the palms of our hands to try and push ourselves along.
Yeah.
And it's quite, I think that affects our independence when you're in lightweight wheelchairs. An electric one gives you much more independence. But at the time, we were all in lightweight wheelchairs sitting around at the nurse's station or watching TV or playing chess or a board game or something. And we sat around for long periods. And there was this moment where, because we were on the first floor, and we used to look down onto the basketball court. Quite why they had a basketball court next to a spinal unit is beyond me. But anyway, they did. There weren't many people playing on it. And one afternoon, Dave and I just got bored. So we on the beds we had in the ward, we just put our hands down, lifted the brakes up off the bed, And between the two of us, you used to see two quadriplegics. What you do is you position yourself, put the brakes on your wheelchair, push the bed one arm's length, yeah. Take your brakes off, move forward an arm's length, brakes on, push the bed.
So it's a long process.
Oh, it's hugely. It took us about an hour and a half. And out through the dining room into the lift, because there were big lifts for beds.
Yeah.
Down the first floor and out onto the basketball court.
That must have been a sight to see.
It was amazing. And Tim doesn't remember it. I think it's because it was Tim's bed. I think Dave and I that did it.
Yeah, yeah.
And it's even funnier that the nurses didn't even notice it. So it just shows.
It's a good story. And like I say, the book is full of little stories like that. Tell us about meeting your wife, because that's quite a romantic story in itself, isn't it?
It's a love story, isn't it? Yeah. Great when you look back and think, you know, I was 18 years old. Elaine was 21, a little bit older than me, giving away her age. And she was my primary nurse, and she looked after me in the ward. It was very relaxed then. The nurses would take the patients out down the pub quite regularly. We'd get back late, get told off and all that stuff, but we just cracked on. So, you know, you become close to people who are looking after you, quite intimately looking after you, getting you washed and dressed. You know, day in, day out, and you are, you know, you stay in the hospital when they go back in the evening and go out partying, come back, and of course the first thing you want to know is how was your night last night, and you do get very attached, and yeah. Elaine and I grew close, and yeah, I think by the following summer I'd asked her to marry me. Wow. And the year after that we got married at 87, I think, so a couple of years till we got married, and we've been married since 87, so that's 36 years this year.
Yes.
I've got a 20-year-old son. So, yeah, still going strong, but we're getting older now and, you know, things are falling apart a bit physically.
It's a lovely story.
Yeah, thank you.
Yeah. Life after – it's Oddstock, the Salisbury Hospital, wasn't it, if I remember
right?
Yeah. Life after Oddstock, when because you started work, you got a degree – and then you started getting into all these amazing achievements, which we'll talk about. And I wouldn't know where to start there because there's so many of them. But what was the first steps in terms of, you know, getting a job and that sort of thing?
So the first big step was, and this is absolutely fundamental to my life story,
yeah.
is this is now 87. The world is starting to hear this word called computers. I couldn't physically do the things I did. I didn't think I'd ever sail again. I just didn't think I could do anything. And I sat at home all day watching TV whilst Elaine was going back and doing nursing and insurance work and stuff. And I saw something in the local paper that the local Southampton City Council were running a training scheme for computing, home-delivered training. So people who were home-based, so stay-at-home mums, disabled people, there were 10 places on this pilot project. I applied and I got one. And over the next year, I was given a computer, a desktop PC, yeah. And I was assigned a tutor. And I specialized in databases as word processing. And this is all, you know, I think this is like 35 years ago. It was primitive stuff. And spreadsheets. And at the end of it, they held a little event in the local, in the guild hall, where they brought together potential employers with people who'd done the course. And I met that evening a chap called Paul Oakley White, who was the senior partner of a little firm at the time called Deloitte Haskins and Sells.
Deloitte, yeah.
Exactly,
yeah.
They are now, but they were Deloitte Haskins and Sells, and yeah. I joined them to help with in the marketing department to help with database management. So those old cardboard punch cards you put into a computer and they go chung, 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 chung.
Yeah, I remember.
And it would pull out all of the, you know, I want everyone with this postcode. Chun, 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 chun. They started computerizing. And so I got a job with them. We merged with, 2 years later, they merged with Coopers and Lybrand to become Coopers Deloitte. They're an accountancy firm, to those that don't know. Through various reasons, I ended up becoming marketing manager of the firm. And then they became Coopers and Lybrand Deloitte, and I decided at that time I wanted to move and prove that I hadn't got that job purely through someone feeling sorry for me.
Yeah.
So I joined a firm called Spicer & Oppenheim, who had just merged with a company called Touche Ross. Are you following me?
Yes. And, there's a theme here, isn't there?
There is. And then Touche Ross, I was head of business management and marketing. And then Touche Ross merged with Deloitte, Deloitte. They took the Deloitte name and then became Deloitte. So I ended up working for Deloitte again, which was absolutely bonkers. But so that, the reason for telling you all of that is those 10, 15 years, it was office based. It was driving me nuts, but I had worked with some amazing people who really didn't, you know, my disability wasn't an issue.
No.
It kind of made me feel comfortable talking about my disability. We'd talk about all sorts of things, and it was never about, oh, my, you know, you're ill or anything.
No.
I felt as if I was an active contributor to the business. But because I was in marketing, I was learning all those skills around, you know, client focus, brand, image, press, you know, business development, you know, all of that important stuff that you learn, you know, driving what is now one of the top three accountancy firms in the world. I should say my responsibility was only my office, the Bournemouth office, and the Cardiff office, I think. So there's only three or four offices, but it was a big budget, lots of people. And those skills I was able to transfer to my later project. Parallel to that, the other important part of the story is in 1991, I got back in a boat again for the first time. So that's 7 years after my accident.
Yeah.
I got back into a little dinghy. Coincidentally, through, again, it may not have time now to explore it, but it's in the book, a lady called Diana Campbell, who coincidentally I had looked after when I worked in a restaurant in Hamble. She was severely disabled, and I remember looking after her. And then after my accident, my wife ended up looking after, doing care work for her. And this disabled lady had designed she was quite wealthy, had designed a type of disabled dinghy that disabled people like myself with my severe disability could sail, this trimaran dinghy called a Challenger. So we got together again, and we reconnected after all this time, and now I was disabled too. And she encouraged me to go sailing in a Challenger. So in 1991, I got in one for the first time. The BBC were there filming it. And I was frightened. I was frightened that I'd have forgotten how to sail. I was frightened that, you know, some people might laugh at me because, you know, I told everyone I was Elaine had never seen me sail. I told Elaine that I'd done all this sailing. And here I was now in a boat on my own on the River Itchen, sort of about to demonstrate that I could sail still. And luckily I hadn't lost it. I understood how it worked. And I made that little boat, you know, go very fast, and it danced for me. And I thought at that point, this is it, you know, I can't ever forget sailing again.
Once you'd overcome the fright, being a little bit scared, once you were going on the water, it all came back.
I would say it took less than 30 seconds.
Oh, wow.
It was that quick. It was that. Yeah. And I was so frightened. Elaine lowered me into the boat. I remember so clearly, she said, I hope you know what you're doing. Because she'd never seen me sail.
No.
And here I was about to, for those that may remember long memories, the River Itchen, where it meets Southampton Water, there used to be a shipbuilders called Vosper Thornycroft. And Vospers would build all of the Royal Navy, a lot of the fast support patrol boats. So when I actually got in the boat, there was a Royal Navy ship the other side of the river. I've got a lovely photo of it with me being lowered in the boat and this Royal Navy ship the other side being fitted out. And, you know, I was frightened I was going to hit it. I genuinely didn't know I was going to be able to sail this boat.
Yeah. And how long did you sail for on that occasion?
Oh, well, I should have been 20 minutes for the TV, but I was out there over an hour. I just disappeared down Southampton. Yeah. And they had to get a dinghy to come and chase me. It wasn't because I was trying to be naughty. I just suddenly felt, oh, I love it. And at that moment, it was one of those, I'm back. And
so you knew then you'd never look back. That was it.
Absolutely. And from then on, the sailing progressed through, you know, to racing, as you mentioned earlier, boats all over the world.
Yeah. And what did people close to you think about getting back into sailing like this?
I never really asked them, but I what was interesting is the world I had inhabited, the yachting marine world I had inhabited, it's quite close. We all know each other. And during the years that I hadn't sailed, there's a lady called Tracy Edwards, who's very famous for, you know, being the first all-female crew to sail around the world. Well, I knew Tracy during that period. We became really good friends. So I was in some ways living my life vicariously through watching Tracy put together a Whitbread, or whatever it was, round the world yacht race at the time. And with putting her crew together, going down to the boat, watching them race and train. So that world's very small. And everyone knew that I had been in that world, and I was, you know, through injury, wasn't part of it. So once I was back part of it, all of a sudden, you know, I was there at boat shows. I was there at, you know, committee meetings. I sat on the RYA, the Royal Yachting Association Council. I sat in that for many, many years, representing disabled sailing. They took me on in 92, and I did, crikey, I did a good 12, 15 years on the council, representing disabled sailing. In this country, I then sat on committees representing the UK on disabled sailing overseas, like the Paralympic Committee. Yeah. And so people started to, oh, that's that Jeff guy, you know, the guy who was a yachtsman who broke his neck. So, yeah, I kind of found myself back in that world, and interestingly, having seen both sides of it. So and what I mean by that is I saw it as an able-bodied yachtsman and never once thought about disability. Never, because no one in my family had ever been disabled. And then I was back in it, right at the epicenter of it, as someone with a very severe disability. And crossing those two lines was very interesting, because those who've always been disabled had kind of grown up in a kind of a community that had not looked beyond those boundaries. Do you know what I mean? They were kind of...
Yes.
The aspirational boundary, their aspirational horizon, there's a nice marine use there. Their aspiration, their horizon was always very low, because that was the world they inhabited. That's why I was thinking, blimey, I want to sail around Great Britain. I want to sail across the Atlantic. I want to do all those things everyone else does. And that kind of leads on, I guess, to the next stage in the story.
It sounded there, Jeff, as though you'd reached some sort of epiphany.
Yeah, and it's only, but I'm not sure I realised it at the time. It's only looking back now over my life, and when I wrote the book, actually, about joining those dots, thinking that's why I was in a position to do what I did.
Yeah.
And one thing I am very clear about, I could not, with all the money in the world, I could not have left hospital and the following week, the following year, done all the sailing that I have done. Yes. It had to be step by step. It had to be so I knew my limits. I knew what I could do and couldn't do.
Yeah, sort of incremental.
Yeah, an incremental. You know, I'm not a great one for quotes, but what I do remember is Churchill saying the chain of destiny can only be achieved one link at a time. And it's that kind of thing. It was one step at a time. It was my apprenticeship.
Yes.
And I look back now thinking, you know, I've done my apprenticeship, and that's why I feel I can talk authoritatively on subjects when it concerns disability and sailing. There's a big thing that happened literally yesterday when the International Paralympic Committee had just announced that sailing will not be reintroduced into the Paralympic Games in 2028. Now, I've been working on that or aware of it on the inside since we were kicked out in 2014. And so for the last, you know, 8-9 years, it's been a major part of my life, particularly because I helped get sailing into the Paralympics in 1996.
Yes.
I was one of the selectors for it. So things like that, you can only talk about authoritatively having done your time. And that's kind of where I feel I am now.
So did you say it's not going to be part of the 2028?
Yeah. So without giving you all of the detail, it was a demo sport in 96 in Atlanta. They loved it. It went to Sydney as a full-blown Paralympic sport. And there's a committee that oversaw that, a Paralympic sailing committee that oversaw that. And they took their eye off the ball, because the Paralympics, they're a precondition. This isn't made-up rules. The precondition is there are a minimum number of countries must play that sport.
Yes.
And I think if it's a one-to-one sport, it's 32 countries, and there must be a minimum number of continents. And they took their eye off the ball, and they were concentrating too much on the racing. And I think we only had about 12 countries. when you put them all together at an international competition. No. And they were reminded time and time again, if you don't up to 32, you're out. They didn't. And in 2014, they were kicked out. And,
so it sounds like the energy might have been better spent canvassing other countries.
Quite 100%. And it isn't just, oh, it's a shame it's not in there. You have to think of all of the, not just the elite sailors who represent the country, of which we had four at every Olympics. We had four sailors at every Olympics. Sorry, no, one, two, three, four, five, six at every Olympics, plus a coach, plus all the other teams. They're all funded by UK Sport. There is a massive industry, and it isn't just those that are there representing your country. It's the ones who are in reserve. It's the ones who they've tried to get there over the years, who've given up their lives to get there, and they're not chosen. And to have it just thrown out, and internationally, it was devastating. Yeah. Anyway, we move on.
We do. Now, I'm not sure if I've got this chronologically correct, but somewhere between these exploits going across the Atlantic and going around the UK, around the British Isles, you got a degree in auctioneering, antiques?
Yeah. So mid to late 90s, my stepdad, who had got me into sailing, passed away. And he had he wasn't rich, but he had a few artifacts that were at the house, and we weren't sure of its value. And I called Bonham's Auctioneers, and they sent someone round. Just, it was only two or three pieces. And this young girl, she was in her mid to late 20s, walked in the house. And as she walked in, she pointed to something up on the wall and said, to a vase, and said, oh, that's a Susie Cooper vase, 1935, probably worth about 300 quid. And she pointed to something else, saying, oh, that's a Meissen monkey band, individual pieces worth, you know, 400 to 500. And I said, whoa, what? She was writing it down. I said, oh, stop right there. How do you know that? You've not even touched it. And she said, well, I said, you can't know everything in the world. She said, no, but she said it's the form, it's the shape of it, it's the decoration of it. She said it's just screaming at it. And she said, if I turn that upside down, that will say, you know, Susie Cooper, whatever the work, you know, the factory was. And she turned it upside down, and sure enough, it did. She never, it was like a magician's trick. And she went through some paintings and some furniture doing the same thing. I just said, where did you get this knowledge? And she said, oh, I did a degree. It used to be Southampton Institute. It's now the Solent Institute. But it used to be Solent University it is now. But it used to be Southampton Institute.
Yeah.
It was the only country, university or higher ed in the country doing a degree in auctioneering and fine art valuation. And within, this was early August, and within 3 weeks I'd enrolled as a mature student. I deliberately did it part-time over 5 years because I was so interested in it.
Yeah.
And it was 2 days a week for 5 years, and I soaked it up like a sponge. I just loved, I couldn't get enough of it. I was living in museums and auction rooms and these things. And it's one of the few degrees I think you can get. I know, like, if you're doing, you know, accounting or whatever, you can use that as a subject to earn your living, but to be taught how to value an object in front of you, to know its worth, and then to translate, if there's the dirty word profit, is there a profit in it, was absolutely amazing. And it coincided with the birth, with the actual flourishing and the birth of online sales.
Yes.
Now, for those that know the word, everyone knows the word eBay now. But no one knew it in 1997. My membership of eBay started in 97, and it didn't come to the UK properly until 2005-06. So I was trading on eBay long before the UK woke up to online sales.
Yeah.
And there's another saying, was it William Morris that said, people know the price of everything and the value of nothing. And that's what's happened now. Everyone, oh, what's that worth? They look on the internet, oh, it's worth a fiver or a tenner. Well, when I did my degree, we were taught how to learn that without going on the internet. And it's paid for a few holidays, that's for sure.
So it was always seen by you as a sort of extra on top of the work you were doing with the accountancy firms, was it?
Yeah, and then I ended up kind of drifting away. I gave my notice at Deloitte and focused on that. And I was dealing, I suppose, it's a horrible word, but I became an antique specialist in early European porcelain. I ran a few auctions privately, did a lot of private valuations, probate stuff. The problem is, as much as I love it, I'm restricted because of my physical disability. I can't go upstairs to value your furniture upstairs. You know, I can't get into 90% of houses or homes because of my wheelchair. And you can't really do it with a camera phone or photographs. No. You've got to feel and touch and hold stuff. So the whole, that whole side of it was difficult. And then even if people brought stuff to me, my hands aren't strong enough to hold a, you know, a table upside down and look at the joints of a table. So I specialized in ceramics, and that's what I still dabble a bit now, a bit of collecting.
So I was going to ask you about what you do now. So you dabble, you've still got an interest in it, but not as much as you used to.
The first thing I ever bought at auction in 97 was, when I started the degree, was a Port Merion coffee pot. It's a big, tall, slim cylinder. And it just amazed me that this thing was, it was designed in the 60s to pour instant coffee. And I just got a bug. I realized that they didn't create a set of them. It wasn't like you can collect 20. It was experimental pottery. So I started collecting that. And now I've got, as my wife will tell you, I've got about 3,000 or 4,000 pieces of early Port Merion pottery sat in my garage roof. Wow. I've got one of the largest collections of Port Merion coffee sets in the world. So that's, yeah, but it doesn't make me money. It just gives me a bit of pleasure. No.
Okay, so while this was going on, you're developing your sailing. What made you, I mean, I think, as I said before, you know, I don't think we necessarily have to get the chronological stuff right in this exactly, but what made you want to do the Round Britain one?
It was genuinely an epiphany moment. Talked about that earlier, after I had sailed around the Isle of Wight.
Yeah.
So, and it was that following morning. So again, without going too much detail, it's not necessary, but I sailed that little Challenger trimaran dinghy that I mentioned earlier. I sailed it around the Isle of Wight, and the Isle of Wight is 55 miles.
So how long did that take?
Well, I did it in 92 and it took 14 hours. And I was, I honestly didn't think I'd ever wake up. I was so upset and tired. It shouldn't take that long. It's 55 miles. And I've been, it took me 5 years to get to the next stage in 97 where I knew I could do it quicker. Yes. There was a whole bunch of stuff I did wrong. Anyway, in 97, I did it in just under 8 hours, which is so about 7 hours, 50 minutes to do 55 miles, which is really quite important. Not the distance, but it meant that I didn't suffer from exposure. My head's only a meter above the water.
Yeah.
You know, the wind, the spray, so there's dehydration, there's exhaustion, there's fatigue, obviously, but also sitting down for 8 hours on my bum. And I can't feel it.
Any listeners who perhaps have nautical tendencies, can you just explain what the vessel is?
So she's a trimaran, which means she has three hulls. Now, if you think when Ellen MacArthur went around the world, she went around in a very big trimaran.
Yeah.
My trimaran is much smaller. It's as long as your dining room table, maybe a little bit longer. Oh. It's just over 50, it's about 15, 14 foot long. So yeah, it's longer than the dining room table, about the length of your dining room. And you sit in the middle hull in a seat, perched upright, at sea level, your bum is kind of at sea level, and your head is no more than a meter above the water. You have your life jacket on. This boat has one sail. It's called a mainsail. And the beauty of the trimaran is that it's quite stable. And you have two controls you have more if you want, but the two basic ones are the main sheet, which is the rope, which pulls the sail in or lets it out. And that's the accelerator. And you have a tiller, a steering bar in your hand, which turns you left and right. And that's about it. You can put tension on the downhaul and outhaul and all of that stuff, but effectively it's a main sheet, which is your accelerator and a steering rod. And that was it. And so in 1997, I set off again, much better equipped, got the tides right, and did it in 7 hours 55. And when I got back, because I thought it was going to be a long day, and it wasn't that long. Yeah. I got back at 4 o'clock, had a really good meal that evening, felt absolutely perfect. I felt really good. Great night's sleep, because, you know, still 8 hours at sea is a long time to be steering a boat. Good 8 hours sleep. Woke up in the morning, and the moment I woke up, and I remember it clearly, I thought to myself, quickly, yesterday I sailed 60 miles around the Isle of Wight yesterday. 60 miles, that was amazing. A good sleep. Sure, I could do that again. I feel I could sail around the Isle of Wight again. And the moment I was thinking I could do it again with a sleep and do it again with a sleep, my mind was always already ahead of my thinking in some way. 60 miles sleep, 60. Well, you can go around anything if you do that. Well, we can go around Britain. And it was literally born then. I remember coming in and said to my wife, do you know, one day I'd like to sail around Britain. You know, I've proved I can sail 60 miles. If I get a good night's sleep, do it again. And that's how it started. It took 2007. So that's 10 years. Yeah, it's 10 years until we got to that point in May 2007 where I had raised the money. I got a sponsor through Blake Lapthorne and a firm of lawyers. Lawyers. I'd got, you know, a team together who had volunteered to give up their time to help me do this. I had a motorhome, wheelchair accessible motorhome, a motorhome for the crew, a Land Rover for the crew, a RIB, which is a rigid inflatable boat, which was my lifeboat. In May we set off on this amazing journey.
It's an enormous project to undertake. How many people were actually sort of with you as you did it?
So with me were nine. So that includes my wife and my five-year-old son, who and myself in a wheelchair living in a motorhome for 100 odd days. I told her it would be 60. Never been in a motorhome in our life. Can you imagine a five-year-old son? You know, we had no radio, no TV. We had nothing, absolutely nothing, just our clothes because it was going to be so intense. We had six members of crew. Again, I'm told 60 days, and they helped drive the vehicles on land and helped drive the support boat at sea. And as it turned out, it was longer than 60 days, so some crew had to duck out, and we were supported by others. But it ended up, you know, that journey took a total of 109 days. We went to 51 harbours around the UK. 51!
51 harbours?
51 of them. Yeah. I know. But you might say, well, it took 109 days, but 51 harbours. So it's on average, the average is kind of a two-day stopover.
Yeah.
It was nothing like that at all. It was nothing. We ended up, one point we were stuck in Abasok for 3 weeks because of the weather, and we thought we were going to cancel the project. So when did finally get going, we sailed every day then for about 8 days whilst we could.
Yeah.
And then the weather gets bad again. So the weather dictated that, and it nearly finished us several times.
Well, it was certainly the voyage itself. It's full of ups and downs in the book. I'm not going to go through every single one there, but could you just sort of illustrate some of the high times and the high times and the low times on that?
I think what will help, just to help paint a picture of it, is understanding my disability and bearing in mind I was at sea for a minimum of 8, 10, 12 hours a day. So we would, there's the actual logistics of it. I would get up at 4:30. Elaine would get me, you know, into my horrible neoprene suit that sticks to your neck. And then I'd appear out of the motorhome at 5 o'clock in the morning. Then I'd get lifted into my little boat. And bear in mind then, my like I said before, my head was a meter above the water. And I'd be snuggy. I just got out of bed, and within 10 minutes, there'd be a wave over my face and it wakes you up. I had a helmet on with comms to the team, and they'd jump in the lifeboat and we'd set off. Now, the reason for saying that is that then all the guys on the land had to pack up at 6 a.m. and get on the road to try and meet us when we got to the next place, wherever that next place may be. And I would arrive, 6 o'clock, 7 o'clock in the evening, absolutely done for. You know, all I could eat was sausage rolls out there because.
So there was no sort of visiting the local pub?
There was none of that. Certainly not for me. I don't think any of us really managed to do that. We were lucky if we got the local fish and chip shop, to be honest. And then I'd arrive and there'd always be people there waiting, the press are often there. Local Rotary Club would be there and there'd be people wanting my signature and photos. And that was all very lovely. And it was like, right, I'm off to my motorhome. I'd get in the motorhome and I'd collapse. Elaine would give me a hot meal, give me a hot shower, and then I'd just go to bed and I was absolutely, you know, wiped out. And that happened day in, day out, with these crazy logistics. you know, sometimes there'd be no water to launch the boat, so it had to be wheeled out across the sand flats to launch. Other times it'd be over rocks to get, because there was no pontoon or jetty.
Yeah.
And it was that. So in terms of the highs and the lows, it was factored against all of that. It just became the norm to feel cold, tired, hungry.
Yeah.
And I guess the if there's one low point, just quickly, the low point was between Arbroath and Dunbar. The tide changed, the wind picked up, changed direction. I was still 5 to 10 miles out of Dunbar. The sun was setting, and the wind got so strong I couldn't control the boat. And every time I went to sail up a wave, the wave pushed me off the wave and pushed me back. It was getting dangerous, and we had a process for that, a plan for that, and that was that the rib would come alongside, and they would make fast to me, and then they would tow me. Well, they couldn't do that because my boat was rearing up and down and would have punctured the inflatable rib.
So it was too dangerous for them.
Yeah. Far too dangerous. Yeah. So what they ended up doing was trailing a warp behind, from behind the rib, which came under my boat. And in the end, I managed to, because I can't grip it, I picked it, I managed to put it on the back of my wrist and wrapped it around my arm about 6, 7, 8 times, just wrapped it. And then they pulled me to them with this rope using my arm as the pull. Sure. And it virtually pulled my arm out of its socket. Yeah. I mean, the pain was excruciating. Anyway, they were able to make a line fast and they towed me in. And that frightened me, because I don't think anyone should ever lose, any yachtsman should lose control of their boat.
No.
And I guess the highlight just has to be crossing the finishing line at the end. It was like Sally Taylor from the local BBC were there. They were covering it live on BBC News. I crossed that line and it was just, I've done it. Yeah. I can't believe I've done it. You know, everyone, all the challenges I went through.
Once you'd done it, how long did it take to start thinking, well, I'm never ever going to do this again, or I need a new challenge?
Well, when I crossed the line, and it's on video, the BBC, it went out on the film, when I crossed the line, I said, what did Steve Redgrave say when he did the Olympics? If you ever see me near a boat again, you have my permission to shoot me. And jokingly, that's it, I'm done for.
Yeah.
And then, you know, it was, I didn't want to get back in a little dinghy again, but we'd been on holiday and I thought, I did that Atlantic when I was younger. Wouldn't it be great to do it again? And that's what I did. So, yeah, 2 years later, I found a disabled person, a friend of mine who's got a big 60-foot yacht that's wheelchair accessible. And again, we found sponsors. I found a carer to come with me on the trip. And yeah, in 2009, November, we set sail from Lanzarote. And 4 weeks later, in early January, we made landfall in Cane Garden Bay, where I broke my neck all those years ago. It wasn't for closure. It wasn't, you know, for all of that stuff. It was just a celebration, really, that I'd managed to achieve these things. Like I say, I wouldn't have been able to do it when I came out of hospital, but no. It took 25 years to get to that stage.
Yeah. Yeah.
And that was great.
So while you were doing all these achievements, which I guess was to prove to yourself how good you could be sailing.
Yeah.
At the same time, you're receiving accolades, you're becoming a motivational speaker, you get to know Princess Anne. You get an MBE.
Yeah, I know. Came. I thought in many ways, bizarrely, I thought if I deserved recognition for anything, it was sailing around Great Britain, but
yeah.
It was the Atlantic. I was up against Robin Knox Johnson for a lot of those things in 2007. He'd done some amazing things. So yeah, in 2011, you're right, I got awarded an MBE for services to sailing, which was quite nice. Not disabled sailing, services to sailing,
yeah.
Which was awarded by the Queen. I was made a Deputy Lieutenant of Hampshire, so I represent the Crown. I have a Lord Lieutenant Nigel here in Hampshire, and I'm one of 40 or so DLs who do citizenship ceremonies, and we sit on various committees and things,
yes.
Which is a huge honour. I mean, that's a massive honour to represent the Crown. I was asked to carry the Olympic torch in 2012, and I did that. So, yeah, all this study coming at once. Had lots of nominations for various awards, BBC awards and things. So I kind of had reached my zenith, I think, at that time. And it was my moment to step back and think, where do I go from here?
Yes. And this is where we come to Wet Wheels, I guess.
Yeah. So, and that's, it's quite nice tie-in. Although I wouldn't, were the previous project, the projects previously may have been, you could call them maybe vanity projects. You know, I wanted to do them because I wanted to test myself. I'm not going to sit here and say I did it to raise awareness of disabled sailing around the world. Although it did that, without me realising it, it did that.
Yes.
And it was having done the Atlantic that I realised I had so many comments, feedbacks, emails, messages, letters, or just unbelievable from around the world, from disabled people and their families. It was hugely positive, and I kept them. I had over 1,000 emails when I got back, and I wrote to every single one of them, would you believe it? That was a mistake, because they all write back and think they're your friend. I had this huge, I found myself thinking, and they're all asking the same question, how do I do it? How do I get involved? And I'm thinking, well, at the moment, you can't. Unless you go sailing a little dinghy at a sailability club, which is great, you can't go on an ocean. There's no way for you to go on an ocean. There's no charity. There's no power boating organisation. There's nothing.
Yeah.
And so apart from a couple of charities overseas. So I thought, well, how do we change this? Let's take out whether sailing is better than power boating. Let's remove the snobbery of sailing's better than power boating. What is it that's special about being on the water? And it's about being out there at one with nature. It's a sensory experience. And you know what? It doesn't matter how you get out there. You need to get out there.
Yeah.
And so I looked at what was available, and there was nothing to get you over the horizon. Certainly those with profound and complex, so I'm talking disabilities. So I'm talking about mostly young people with life-limiting disabilities who may have one or more complex challenges in their life.
Yeah.
And there was no way for them to get out and spend a day out on the water, you know, going fast, having fun. So I started Wet Wheels. I wrote an article in a local paper. I did a monthly article, and it was called My Powerful Secret. That was it. And I talked about all the power boat options for wheelchair users and how they were all they weren't any good apart from one, which was the Cheetah Catamaran.
Yeah.
And it was amazing. And that was it. And I said, and I finished the article by saying I always did have champagne tastes and lemonade pockets. Anyway, cut to the next month. I'm writing the next month's article, and I get a phone call from the owner of the company saying, thanks for that lovely write-up of our boat, but how do you know you can't afford it? And I said, well, you know, I've seen your price list. And he said, well, come and talk to us. Maybe we can speak to engine suppliers and electronic suppliers, and maybe we can find a way to do it. So I went to talk to him, and we did get support from Suzuki with engines and Raymarine with electronics and all other smaller supporters. Cheetah Marine gave us a little discount, and I part mortgaged my house.
Oh, so you actually purchased the first one yourself, basically.
I had some skin in the game. I had 50% of that, maybe more than 50% of its costs was, you know, came out of my pocket.
Yeah.
Because I didn't know what this was going to become. I just wanted an entity. And within the year one, we'd taken, I remember the first time it really dawned on me I had an issue is when we took a group out and we took them out for a trip, and I came back and had to fill up with petrol, and I filled it up, and it was £600 to fill it up. And I thought,
£600.
I can't afford to be doing that. I can't do it.
Yeah.
How's this going to work? So I thought, right, if we become a not-for-profit organization, then people can write me a check. And someone did write me a very generous check to start with, a friend of mine, and she wrote it to me personally. And I remember that's the moment when I thought, this isn't going to work transparently. You know, if people are going to write me checks, it's got to be to an organization. It can't be to Jeff Holt.
Yes.
Yeah. So we moved that money into it. We started Wet Wheels Solent CIC.
Yeah.
And off we went. And then the following year, we took 600 to 800 people. And I realized this, I've got something here. And literally the following year, I was speaking at an event in the Isle of Wight, and the guys from Jersey were there. There's some charity called Le Tournoi on a sailing challenge. And they asked me to talk. So I went over. It was at the Royal Corinthian Yacht Club in Cowes. And I went over on Wet Wheels, and I left my boat in the little harbour below at the Royal Yacht Squadron. And during the interval, the guys at from Le Tournoi said, how did you get here? And I pointed out the window, and I said, I came over in my boat, Wet Wheels. and he asked what Wet Wheels was. They invited us to the boat show in Jersey, and within 6 months, they had raised the money to buy their own Wet Wheels.
Oh, that's
amazing. So now that was Wet Wheels 2.
Yeah,
and all of a sudden, this people started seeing and recognizing. And you jump to where we are now. Wet Wheels Edinburgh was launched this week.
So how many have you got now then, Jeff?
So Wet Wheels Edinburgh, which was launched this week, is our seventh Wet Wheels boat. They're all identical. They're 9-meter Cheetah catamarans. They're built on the Isle of Wight. They all powered by twin Suzuki engines, 325 horsepower on the back of each. And they've all got Raymarine electronics. They all look almost absolutely identical. It's very hard to tell the difference. And and that kind of comes from my background with Deloitte about brand, how important brand is to keep everything on message. And so we also train our own people. All the skippers have commercial endorsements. So they're commercially endorsed skippers because all the boats are what's called coded, which is a government standard for safety. And then we train all of our volunteer crew to a maritime training program, which we've developed for Wet Wheels, which is bespoke. And so it means that wherever someone with a disability goes on the boat, they're going to have a similar experience in terms of friendliness and safety. Yes. One thing I haven't mentioned, of course, is actually how it works. So every boat can take 10 passengers. It's licensed to take 10 passengers plus 2 crew.
Yeah.
Of those 10, 3 of them can be in wheelchair users. We get them across on a really heavy-duty ramp onto the boat, and there are securing points on the deck, 4 points to each wheelchair, which we've designed and developed with the straps. And so disabled people can come with mums and dads and brothers and sisters. And the other absolute USP of Wet Wheels is everyone, regardless of disability, can go up under the steering wheel and drive the boat.
Oh, wow.
Which is phenomenal when you think, these boats are getting on for $250,000 each. They'll do up to 30 knots, and you've got someone with a profound disability. Now, I'm not saying they're driving the boat on their own. That would be absolutely illegal. So our skippers hold the throttles. They don't go near the throttles. But it means they can put their hands on the wheel. And if they can't put their hands on the wheel, my captains will put their hands on the wheel for them. But in their wheelchairs, they come up under the steering wheel. Yes. And they are where the captain sits. They are looking at a chart plotter. They are looking at depth sounder, speed instruments, wind, hydrographic instruments, fish finders. They're looking at all of that VHF radios. They're seeing it all. And those that can understand will have it explained to them. And the captain will stand there with them alongside saying, turn left a little bit towards that mark, turn right a little bit. And that is so empowering. That is something you can't put a price on, really.
Yeah. And these the people that go on, I mean, do they make return visits? Can they come again?
Yeah, they do. So this is it would be great if we had the capacity to take everyone lots and lots of times. But we are so busy and full that it's not us that makes that decision, Bob. If we are working with a school or a college or a charity, the ones that are paying for it and deciding who comes, they will often make the decision who comes that day.
Yes.
So it's not down to us. We love it when people come again. They often love it when they do come again. We work with people with, all ends of the spectrum, including dementia at the older end. We work a lot with disabled veterans. So it's not just wheelchair users, blind, autistic, all sorts of spectrums. And they all get something out of it in a different way. And each boat, on average, each boat's taking 1,500 people a year, each boat. Collectively, we must have taken well over 50,000 now since we started 10 years ago.
Yeah.
It's a shared experience, which I said it's, and that in itself is quite important.
Yeah. Do you have any stories of passengers who've actually been inspired to sort of do something themselves in terms of going on water?
Well, signposting is an interesting one. We always try and signpost them to other activities on the water, and much depends on their capability. And there's a great organisation near us called RORO, or the Disabled Sailors Association, who have a charity sailboat, a catamaran, a bit like us, but a sailboat. So we signposted them there. But I guess the biggest one is probably we've done a case study on him, a guy called Chris, who he's autistic, quite severely autistic. He has Asperger's, and he came on our boat 3 years ago. He used to come on every summer in the Isle of Wight, in Yarmouth, and he'd come on with his little toy Thomas the Tank Engine train, a little plastic one. And he's a big, tall lad. He's about 17 years old, 18 years old. Big, tall, come on with Mum and Dad, and he'd sit in the back, and he'd hold his Thomas the Tank Engine and fiddle with it and rock as we went for, you know, as we went. And the faster we went, the more he'd fidget with his Thomas the Tank Engine. And about a year, no, 18 months ago when we were there, Keith said, would Chris like to drive? And I said, well, I don't know. I'll ask Mum and Dad. So I asked Mum and Dad, and they said, no, he's quite happy where he is.
Yeah.
And I said, you sure? And in fact, Keith came out, and he didn't ask Mum and Dad. Keith came out and went straight to Chris and said, you coming out to drive? And Keith, and the young lad stood up. Bear in mind, he's wearing a red sort of helmet on his head because he hurts his head. And he followed Keith, took his arm, followed him, sat on the seat. And Mum and Dad were amazed. And then Keith, for the next half an hour, drove around pointing to different things. And he was following his instructions perfectly. Left here, stop, right there, stop towards that. Absolutely perfect. Mum and Dad, I don't want to get too emotional about it, but they were in bits. They were really, really moved by what was happening, and they were holding each other, and I could see that they hadn't realized Chris could do these things. And then lo and behold, last summer we got a note from Mum with all these photographs saying, since Chris did that, Chris has now taken up kayaking,
wow,
paddle boarding, swimming, he loves the sea so much they can't keep him out of it, and he's doing all of these things, and that they never thought that he could.
No, and what an amazing story, though. Just shows some of the results that you get by doing this.
And you can't script that.
No.
So that's what's going to happen.
No. So in terms of sponsorship and support for Wet Wheels, how does it work? I mean, if we've got any listeners who would like to get involved at all, what should they do?
So each operator, each of those seven I've named, by the way, Wet Wheels 8 arrives next year in Torbay. So,
oh, right.
You know, we're forever moving forward.
Yeah, well, I'll put the links on, Jeff, so that everybody can have a look at it.
So each operator, when you do click those links, we'll show you where they're based. And if there's someone local to you, an operator local to you, they will have their own Just Giving link, because each operator has to raise the thick end of £70,000 to £80,000 a year per year to operate, and that is never ending. That's a perennial cycle that starts every January when we have to look at our year ahead with zero in the bank. How do we get £70,000?
Yeah.
So every operator is raising that in a number of different ways. We do ask people to contribute where they can, so that offsets a lot of the money. But it's sponsorships and it's personal donations, events, golf days. And if anyone likes their golf, do please get in touch with me. We've got an amazing golf day in May. And then we have, so each operator is set up as a CIC, limited by guarantee, company doing that. And then at the top, we have the national charity, which is the Wet Wheels Foundation. And they oversee all the operations. And the foundation, you know, is also costing about £70,000 or £80,000 a year. And they also, their relationships are slightly different. They tend to go more long-term with corporates. So Sport England, for example, are currently funding a four-year program through us. And we're working with an insurance company called Pantaneous, who are looking to support our operators with insurance to help lower core costs. And obviously Suzuki and Raymarine are up there too. So corporately tends to be more the national organization. And then more operational is down at the operator level, and with Just Giving links, we're all the same organization.
Yes.
But we've separated out the Just Giving links. So if someone in Hamble, for example, wants to donate specifically to the Hamble boat, they would click on Hamble and make their donation, then it would go to them rather than it going to the main pot. So, and it's a never ending cycle. Every operator in the country will, my Wet Wheels operators will all be holding their head in their hands at the moment, looking at that blank balance sheet. But we get through it. It happens.
Yeah. Jeff, it's an absolutely incredible story, that how you sort of had this idea and you've transformed, you know, you gave the example there of that lad. But what it's doing for people and some of the other projects that you've done, you know, the challenges that you've had going around the British Isles, et cetera, et cetera. What's your philosophy on life?
I think looking back on it, it's taking opportunities, preparing to take a bit of risk. It's very easy, particularly, and I don't want to get too deep, but particularly over the last 2 years, a lot of, you know, 2.5 years, a lot of us have been frightened into, you know, even myself, I didn't leave my house for a year during COVID. Yeah. And found myself, of all people, found myself getting agoraphobic, found myself preferring to stay in rather than go out and do what I normally did. But it's only when, and this is genuinely true, and I'm a firm believer, it's nothing spiritual, it's genuinely my belief, you make your own luck. So, you know, sitting in your house doing something, that is not going to come to you.
No.
But going for a walk to the local library and meeting someone, things just change. There's this synchronicity in life, which is very odd, that, you know, we don't know how it works. And things happen by going out and meeting people and talking to people, and come up with some of your own ideas. Don't be afraid to give it a go. And, you know, if you make mistakes, learn from it. I know that sounds a bit cliche, but
no, I can certainly relate to that. I think it's everything that you've done, reading about it and reading the book and on our conversation, you haven't sort of just sat at home and planned everything to the nth degree. You've had a rough idea, you've had a vision, you've done some basic research into it, and particularly some of these trips where you have to get people together. But then you go for it, and the universe almost sort of conspires with you, doesn't it?
It's really interesting you should say that, because when I started Wet Wheels and I started looking at, you know, funding and looking at different options for funding, everyone was asking for business plans. And, you know, I'd spent my life at Deloitte. Every year we had to review the business plan, and it was this massive document that sat on the shelf. And, you know, and I just absolutely, what you just said, come up with a plan, come up with the basics, and the universe will look after itself. You know, I've made so many mistakes, but I tell you what, I've learned from them by making them. And I, you know, the mistake, the big error is to make them twice. Make them once by all means and learn from them. And I've learned so much about accounting. I've learned so much about running a business. So much, you know, in more perhaps about marketing and PR than I did before, just by giving it a go and not being afraid.
That's
there you go.
Very inspirational, Jeff. Now, Jeff, this might seem like a silly question, but have you got anything coming up? Any new projects?
So there's a couple of things. There's two or three things I'd love to see before I, wherever I go in 20, 30 years' time. I would love to see Wet Wheels international. Yeah. I think Wet Wheels would just fly internationally, but it's someone being brave enough to spend $250,000 to buy a boat on the off chance, and it would take. But then, of course, you've got to run it. Anyway, I won't worry about the detail, but I'd love to see that happen. Yeah. I also, parallel to this, for the last 4 or 5 years, I had been pushing very hard. I've stopped now on a project to sail around the world, to become the first severely disabled person to captain a yacht around the world.
Wow.
And the reason I've stopped is I have three times been on the brink of it happening, three times. And what I mean, I'm talking about a £5-6 million project. And if you imagine that, the work that goes into that, the finding someone who may sponsor you and getting to the very edge. And I'm, you know, if I told you that I, you know, in Monaco, the highest level in Monaco had made personal introductions to people who could provide that sponsorship in a blink of an eye. And on two occasions that happened out there where this was just going to happen. And then the following day or week, things happen and then things change and it doesn't happen. The reason I'm saying that, and it happened once in this country about 2 years ago with someone who's incredibly wealthy, is because I can't physically keep getting to that point where I go to bed one night thinking, that meeting I've just had, he's going to write a check for £5 million, and tomorrow my life changes. Not just my life, but my world changes. My husband, my wife, my son, and disabled people around the world's lives are going to change forever. And then you say, then you find out it's not going to happen. And it's, I can't keep going to that point. The project is still, you know, oven ready, to use a Boris term. It's sat there waiting. But I've lost, my heart's gone because I can't keep going there. So unless someone listening to this is going to make it happen, don't contact me. And the final thing, this is going to sound a bit weird. I would love to, and I've started creating a series of Wet Wheels adventures books for children.
Oh yeah.
Think Thomas the Tank Engine.
Yeah.
But for Wet Wheels. So, you know, Thomas has all of his engines that are anthropomorphized into humans. So, you know, different whatever. All those boats out there have different characters. And I've started writing some stories. I'm not a brilliant writer, and I do need an illustrator, because I think that would be great to promote Wet Wheels. But also, unlike Thomas the Tank Engine, Wet Wheels exists. So if children get enthused by it, they can actually come out on a boat.
Yeah.
And then help raise money for the foundation. So that's kind of
still my going.
So I think you get the idea. I'm not quite a polymath, but my brain's all over the place.
Yes. Well, no, that sounds great. Now, where can people reach if they want to find out more about what you're doing, Jeff?
So the best thing, there's two websites which are really good. One is the wetwheelsfoundation.org. Wet Wheels Foundation is all one long word .org, and that takes you to the main site, and you can learn about the trustees, the work we do, and the individual operators. Or my own personal site, where there is a lot of the detail we've talked about today, is simply jeffholt.com, Jeff with a G. And that, either of those sites will give you, or you can sit on Google, type my name in, and spend the rest of the day watching videos and interviews.
Do you know what? Before this interview, I did that, and it comes up pretty quickly. Yeah, you're
there's quite a lot there, isn't it?
Yeah, there even is.
For me,
yeah.
I'd sit there and think, I don't remember doing that.
No, it's been great. So I'll put all those links on the show notes for people. And after, this must be 39 years since I last saw you very briefly. Maybe we'll talk again. Not in the next 39, but a lot sooner.
Yeah, let's not leave it that long next time, Bob.
Thanks ever so much for coming on the show, Jeff. It's been an absolute pleasure.
Thanks for having me.
You have been listening to Undercurrent Stories. I hope you've enjoyed this episode. Please feel free to share the show link to your friends and family. And if you have 60 seconds, I will be most grateful if you would please rate and review. To hear more episodes, please subscribe to the show and visit undercurrentstories.com. If you leave your email in the link, we will notify you as soon as new episodes are released. Also, check out our social media links, details of which can be found on the show notes. Until next time, this is Bob Wells wishing you all the very best.